Jackson County versus State of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and 05AP545, Jackson County versus State of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We have Jackson County appearing by Brian Butler. We then have Eric McLeod appearing for 15 minutes for Jackson County Landfill, Inc. and Thomas McNulty. And then we have 15 minutes by Tom Dawson of the Department of Justice, which is an add-on that we didn't expect, but they're here. And so I'll tell you one of the questions we're going to ask both Mr. Butler and Mr. McLeod and Mr. Dawson is, should the Department of Justice be here, and what issues are before the court that have to be resolved with or without the Department of Justice? Am I right? The Department of Justice is representing DNR?
Yes.
Okay. Well, got that clarified. Good. Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Brian Butler. With me are Richard Eady and Daniel Gustafson, my partners at the law firm of Stafford Rosenbaum in Madison. They're here because they wrote the briefs. I have 3 points. Not to say that the other points raised in our briefs are unimportant, but these are the three that I want to emphasize. The first is that the law should give government broad discretion to correct its mistakes. The second is that the court should not create the new legal right requested by McNulty. I'm going to use McNulty as shorthand for Mr. McNulty and Jackson County Landfill Incorporated, the respondents. The third point is that issues of fact preclude summary judgment on the county's alternative claims. To the first point, that the law should give government broad discretion to correct its mistakes. Someone once said that we should be a government of laws and not of men, but of course we are a government of men and women, human beings, and human beings err. They make mistakes. Presidents, mayors, county executives, governors, even the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. All these have occasionally made mistakes. Legislators decide that a law they passed was improvident and should be repealed. Judges make mistakes.
Now you've gone too far.
I'm going to say present company excluded, but you have observed that your predecessors on the bench have occasionally made mistakes. And mistakes by government can be harmful. They can hurt the government and they can hurt the citizenry. So if the law unduly restricts the ability of government, all branches of government, to correct errors, then the government's in trouble and the citizens that the government serves are in trouble.
Mr. Butler, I can understand that broad principle, but is there a difference where you have vested rights involved?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, and I'm going to cover that in my second point, if I may.
Certainly.
The problem raised by this case is how much leeway should government have, and my argument is that the leeway should be broad, that the law should foster the ability of government to correct errors and not impede it. But the second point is, goes to the vested rights question, and my second point is that the law should not create the new legal right requested by McNulty. Government action that is aimed at correcting mistakes, all government action for that matter, is limited or is subject to the individual rights that are protected by the state and federal constitutions and other laws. But there is no recognized individual legal right at stake here. Mr. McNulty asks the court to create a new right which is the right to retain a windfall. And the court should rebuff that effort.
I have a question for you. What's the what was the mistake here?
The mistake was taking the tax deed.
Okay. But all the procedure for doing the tax deed was fine. They just shouldn't have taken it.
They shouldn't have taken it.
And the reason they shouldn't take it is because it cost Jackson County a lot of money, maybe.
It may.
To clean up the situation.
Yes, Your Honor.
The waste. Okay. Now it's the second right. You say that that they'll retain a windfall. What does that mean?
That McNulty.
Yes.
Wishes you to give him a right to retain the windfall. That is, he's off. He'll be off the hook. He won't.
He may be off the hook.
He may be off the hook. He will not have.
But cleaning up.
If the DNR issues the county a license, which it has said it wishes to do, McNulty will be off the hook.
Was Jackson County euchred into making a mistake?
Well, we don't know that. And the reason we don't know is that summary judgment was granted against us. We weren't able to take Mr. McNulty's deposition and explore that very question. Did he have in mind when he stopped paying taxes, euchering the county into taking this land?
Mr. Butler, had he stopped paying taxes at the point where the landfill was no longer operational?
Your Honor, I believe he stopped before that. It was shortly before that. But the right he's asking you to create is a right to refuse to be returned to the status that he occupied before the county made its mistake. And if one asks why should he be given this right, his answer in substance is, you know, I just really don't want this to happen to me. I would prefer to keep my windfall. And if I don't want it to happen to me, it shouldn't happen to me. My desire to avoid resumption of my previous status as the landowner should trump the county's ability to correct its mistake.
Mr. Butler, I know you've referred to this as correcting a mistake. I suppose your opposing counsel would categorize this as merely the county changing its mind. There was nothing mistaken about it. It's just the county decided, well, we don't want it. How would you respond to that?
I would say that is really just another way of saying that what I'm saying, and whether you call it a mistake or you say the county is changing its mind, I suggest that sound public policy is served by permitting the government to change its mind,
And how long does the government have to change its mind? As I understand the facts, the county had perfected its interest and had the property for a year, is that correct?
Yes.
So how long does the county have to exercise this rescission right or change its mind?
As long as it needs. The question is whether vested rights are affected by the change, and if there aren't any, then the time shouldn't matter.
But if there are, I mean, what you're asking is somewhat unique. You're asking for rescission. My question would be, where does this court, or you don't want us to even think about drawing lines, if we were to indicate that you should prevail, you're saying we'll assume it is a vested right. Is it 2 years, six? Or should we just say, well, in this case, because of these facts, that you should prevail and not worry about that?
I think the passage of time could create vested rights. But if none is created by whatever the mistake the governmental unit made, it seems to me that is the test that the court has established in the Edwards case and in the Kenosha County case. Are vested rights affected or aren't they? And a time limitation has not been set. And to answer your question, I don't know how really It seems to me it's probably a legislative function to, if there's to be a kind of statute of limitations on the government correcting mistakes, then I suppose that's for the legislature to address. And I don't think you have to address it in this case.
Mr. Butler, I'm always concerned about the ramifications of any decision that we make and how it might apply in other situations. And I can envision situations where, for sake of argument, you have building code violations where the person stops paying their tax bill and the county, particularly in urban areas, the county might come in or a city might come in and invoke a tax deed. And then the question becomes, is the city or is that county now on the hook for the building code violations that exist within the property that resulted in some of the difficulties to begin with? You understand?
Yeah, I would suppose it depends on what the building code says, and does it make a successor owner, in particular a municipal successor owner, liable under those circumstances? And I guess we can't know that without the particular code before us, but that's certainly a conceivable risk, not unlike the one here. So I suggest the issue before you is quite stark. Do you permit the government to correct a mistake, or do you give this novel legal right to McNulty, the right to...
What did the trial court hold here?
The trial court held that the city, that the county owned, took title and couldn't...
Could not correct the mistake. And it went further, didn't it?
Yes.
What did it hold?
Well, there were two decisions by the court, one on motion for reconsideration. It held not only that the county was the owner by virtue of the tax deed, but also that the county's several other claims should be dismissed as a matter of law. And those claims were based on, the claims were essentially, well, if we do own the land, still we don't have the responsibility for the landfill.
You don't have to pay to clean it up.
Right.
All right. What's before this court? Which of those two issues, or both?
Well, I think what's before this court is whether the county owns the land or effectively rescinded that. And the second issue before the court is whether the circuit court properly granted summary judgment under the circumstances as to the alternative claims.
Okay. So that's a summary judgment issue, which is a legal issue.
The second one?
Mm-hmm.
I think if...
Is that before us? Let me put it this way. Is that before us, and is that what you all briefed? Some of the briefs are yes, some no. But the certification indicates, which doesn't bind us, of course, the certification indicates that, as to the second issue, maybe we send that one back.
That's
okay with you, because you get another shot at it. I understand that.
That's what we asked.
But can we deal with that second issue?
Well, I don't think you can. If you're asking, can you decide the legal issues raised by the alternative claims, I think with respect to at least three of them, the answer is no, because they are disputed facts.
Okay, which three of those? So give me the other two, since that may be shorter. If there aren't disputed facts.
The three are whether Section 289.46(1) applies. The second is the equitable claim that the county makes, that it would be inequitable to allow McNulty to avoid his long-term care obligations by non-payment of taxes. That's the Euchering claim. And the third is that it would be inequitable to permit the DNR to shift to the county the burden of the DNR's failure to secure long-term expenses.
Those should not, you say, because of the, you say they not to be handled by summary judgment because of the fact disputes.
That's
is that
correct,
right?
Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
How many years of taxes were not paid?
I believe two. 2, 3.
And if you prevail that the county can rescind, how does the county get its taxes?
Well, they aren't really the county's taxes. They're the town's taxes. The county collects them, and perhaps the county doesn't. I don't know what other enforcement measures are available, but I suspect the county would not take the land by tax deed again. I think they got it.
But, I mean, if I'm a property owner and I have property that I know the county doesn't want, can I just stop paying taxes?
I don't know the answer to that question because I don't know what other mechanisms are available to collect those taxes other than tax deed. I suspect there are, but I don't know what they are.
Well, if there isn't some other mechanism, you lose either way, don't you? No taxes,
well,
or
we would lose the taxes on this land, which McNulty claims is worthless anyway. But that's a small price to pay for avoiding the potentially multi-million dollar liability of a cleanup.
Mr. Butler, you mentioned Section 289.46, the equitable claims, and the DNR claims is perhaps is having issues of disputed fact. What about the claims under 75.14 and in the scheme under 75.14, 292.11, sub 9E? Do those have disputed facts, or are they appropriate for summary judgment?
I think they probably are. I mean, the question is, amenable to summary judgment. I mean, I think the question is, which is the statute of general application, 246 or 75? And it's probably a matter of law. But I do want to emphasize the point that the right that McNulty is asking you to create here is a novel one. And the reason I say that is that courts in these cases, this court included, uphold government rescissions of actions unless the party opposing the rescission can show detrimental reliance.
Mr. Butler, what bothers me is how do we determine whether or not we're dealing here with a vested right or not? What are the criteria that we bring to bear on that particular issue?
The criteria that were announced in the Edwards case and in the Kenosha County case were reliance on the government action that has now been rescinded by the party opposing the rescission, and reliance such that the party opposing it suffered some detriment. And McNulty makes no such claim. He does not claim that he relied to his detriment. So to wrap up on point two, I think the court's paramount concern should be to encourage the correction of governmental mistakes where the only countervailing consideration is a citizen's desire to avoid being put back in the same position the citizen occupied before the government erred. It's a simple issue, but it's very important, not only to county government, but I suggest to all levels of government and all branches of government.
Counselor, there is in the certification a statement that there was a request to strike the DNR's brief because they didn't file a cross appeal. And we have the DNR arguing before us today. Do you take any position on that before us, or are we free to address that issue if we choose to find that we can do so at this level?
Well, we took the position at the Court of Appeals mm-hmm. that the DNR should not be able to raise certain issues that it did in its Court of Appeals brief, and the motion was granted in part such that the DNR's requests for relief were stricken, but the statements in support of those requests were not. So our position here is the same as that of the Court of Appeals, that the requests for relief should not be considered, but it seems that the statements that were made in support of
them. What was the request for relief?
I don't remember. It was, I think there were two requests. One was to clarify the trial court's holding as to one of the statutes that exempts the county from spill liability, and to clarify it in a way that made it clear that the county's exemption was limited. And the other one was, they didn't want the court, the DNR doesn't want the court deciding whether it, if the county does own the land, whether the DNR should transfer McNulty's license to the county. They say that's an administrative function. The courts should let us do what we will with that and not tell us what to do.
Does the record reflect whether there is or was a valid license at the time of the transfer of the or the tax deed was acted upon by the clerk, or does the record reflect whether the license has lapsed?
It does not. That's another reason summary judgment was improper, because 289.46.1 operates only if the facility was licensed at the time of the acquisition by the county, and we don't know whether it was or not. I'm to my third point, and I just want to make two preliminary observations before I go into my third point, which is that there are issues of fact that preclude summary judgment on the county's alternative claims. The first point is this. McNulty is responsible for the long-term care of this facility regardless of the fact of whether or not that license expired, in answer to you, Justice Butler, because when he got the license, he had to agree to provide long-term care. So he's on the hook, as he should be. He got that license. He got the privilege of making a profit with this business. He avoids his obligation for long-term care only if the DNR transfers the county or the license to the county. Second observation is this. It's understandable why McNulty would try to take advantage of the county's mistake. We're all human. Not only do we make mistakes, but if we can, we avoid responsibilities that we'd really rather not have. But the DNR, why is the DNR trying to take advantage of a mistake by another governmental unit and transfer the liability for long-term care, which is rightfully McNulty's, to the taxpayers of Jackson County? Seems wrong. It seems very wrong. As I said in response to Justice Abramson, there are three claims where we believe there are issues of fact. The application 289.46.1, the issues of fact are, was the facility licensed at the time the county acquired it, or was it within the meaning of 289.46.2, quote, land where a solid waste disposal facility was previously operated, end quote, because if it was that, then sub 2 applies, and it imposes a much less rigorous burden on the county than sub 1. Another issue of fact raised by the 289.46 claim, what does the DNR mean when it uses the word license in its practice? How does it construe that word? We don't know because we weren't allowed to do discovery. Another issue, what are the facts relevant to the degree of deference that you would pay to the DNR's construction of this statute? There are those three levels of deference to administrative decisions, and which level applies depends on the factual circumstances. We don't know those factual circumstances because summary judgment was erroneously granted. The second claim, the Eucharine claim, we want to take Mr. McNulty's deposition. I think it would make a difference to a court in deciding whether it was equitable to hang us with the McNulty long-term care responsibility if he schemed to do this from the beginning. And finally, the claim that it would be inequitable to permit the DNR to shift to the county the burden of the DNR's failure to secure long-term expenses. If the DNR didn't exact from McNulty enough of a set-aside for long-term care and was negligent in its failure and now simply wishes to the county to bear the burden of its negligence, that, it seems, is a consideration that any court would weigh in deciding whether what they seek here is equitable. That is my argument. Thank you, Your Honors.
What about the concept that there has to be a cross appeal by the DNR? 809.10.2b says a respondent, that would be the DNR here, who seeks modification of a judgment or order appealed from or another judgment or order shall file a notice of cross appeal. They did not file, DNR did not file a notice of cross appeal. The Court of Appeals says, okay, you didn't file, you're not before the court. Well, that may be true, but then there's a certification, and now it's here. Are we faced with the same issue of
They said that the DNR was not before the court. I think they said...
So I'm saying that the issue is, can we handle DNR's requests in Section 2 and 3 for modifications to the appealed order when there's been no cross appeal?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
What part of the order is being modified? I didn't notice that there was anything that the trial court said that the DNR wanted to modify.
I think the two modifications they want in the trial court's order are a clarification of the spill liability of the county, if the county's the owner, and second, a ruling by the court that whether to transfer the license from McNulty to the county is an administrative matter to be handled by the DNR and that the court should not speak to that.
Right, but the trial court didn't decide that.
The trial court...
Or did they decide
it?
I know there was a decision and a motion for reconsideration and a decision. I didn't see it, but I could have read it too quickly.
Well, that's why I asked you what the trial court decided.
It may be... What they're seeking is an add-on.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember whether the trial court if the trial court made an intimation on that issue.
Okay, thank you very much.
The trial court held the county liable for cleaning up, right?
Beg pardon?
Did the trial court hold the county liable for cleaning up? Isn't that here yet?
Not. That was the trial court's understanding of its rule.
Decision. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Eric M. McLeod, representing Jackson County Landfill, Inc., and Thomas McNulty. Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Eric McLeod of Michael Best and Friedrich. I represent Jackson County Sanitary Landfill, referred to as JCSL, and Thomas McNulty. Also here is Charles Sweeney, who represents those same parties. I will be dividing my time today with Assistant Attorney Tom Dawson, as you know. He will be addressing the issues related to the responsibility for the property going forward. I will be addressing those issues related to the county's ownership. On behalf of JCSL and McNulty, we certainly appreciate the opportunity to appear before the court today. This court should affirm the circuit court's decision that Jackson County is the owner of the property because the county did not and could not rescind the tax deed that the county clerk had previously issued to the property. This court should also affirm the circuit court's decision that as the owner of the property, the county has responsibility for maintenance of that property going forward. Before I proceed into my prepared outline, I'd like to respond briefly to the initial two points that Mr. Butler raised concerning his statement that the law should give broad discretion to correct errors and that the court should not create some new legal right that would provide a party such as my clients in this case with a windfall. As to the first point, there is law that addresses this question. But before we get to the specific law which we've cited, and there's statutory law that specifically governs this issue, it's important to note that the primary purpose of statutes and rules that that govern the rights and interests in real property are designed to provide certainty as to those interests in real property. The statute of frauds is the clear example, which is conveyances must be in writing so as to evidence the interests in real property. It's to provide certainty, because without certainty as to the interests and ownership rights in property, we would have a system of real property ownership that could be fairly chaotic. The same principle applies here to the principal statute which governs this case, and that's Wisconsin Statute Section 75.22. And that states that a tax deed is presumptively valid, or the purpose of that is to state that a tax deed is presumptively valid so that parties can depend on its validity, whether that's the county, whether it's a subsequent purchaser of that property, whether it's the former owner of that property. A tax deed is presumptively valid because it vests interests and rights in certain parties, and it divests other parties of those rights and interests. And importantly, Section 7522 specifically limits the circumstances under which a tax deed can be canceled. It states, and I'll paraphrase, "No certificate or conveyance," which refers to a tax deed, "shall be deemed invalid within the meaning of this section by reason of any mistake or irregularity in any of the tax proceedings not affecting the groundwork of the tax." The parties concede that the groundwork of the tax refers to the underlying validity of the tax proceedings, the assessment, the imposition of the tax, the issuance of tax certificates, and all proceedings giving rise to the tax deed. There has been no allegation by the county that there has been a mistake with respect to the underlying tax proceedings, that there was no tax owed, that the imposition of the tax was excessive, or anything of the sort. There has only been assertions that the county simply doesn't want this property because of the nature of its use. There's an assumption here that this is something that the county would result in county liability, but nothing that establishes that this property actually has no value. And if that's in fact the only basis which would give rise to invalidity of a tax deed, they must show that in fact this property has no value, and that was the basis for invalidating the tax deed in the first instance, which they've not sought to show here.
Well, Mr. McLeod, I'm looking at page 5 of your brief to this court, in the second paragraph and in footnote 2, and it says, "In 1998, JCSL stopped paying general property taxes on the property." It kicked down to the footnote. JCSL believed the property had no value and accordingly should not be subject to the imposition of property taxes.
That was the view of Thomas McNulty at the time, that this property had no value to him. But that is not and cannot be the legal standard for a determination of whether this property has value. For this court to make a determination that the rescission of this tax deed or the attempted rescission was valid and that this tax deed has been canceled, there must be some showing that in fact this property has no value. The county never sought to get an appraisal of this property. It never sought to sell the property to determine if there was a buyer out there. That would be the measure of whether or not this has fair market value. The property could potentially be expanded for additional landfill capacity. And in fact, municipalities and counties throughout the state of Wisconsin operate landfills. This is not some new and unusual circumstance where a county has now come in possession of a landfill. Counties throughout the state own them. They operate them. There's been no showing in this case on the part of the county that they based their attempted rescission of this tax deed because they had determined that there was some mistake that underlied this tax deed, that showed it had no value, because arguably it does have value and somebody could make value out of it. There are uses for landfills throughout the state of Wisconsin which are becoming quite common. Landfills are being used for golf course construction. Landfills are used to generate methane gas, which is taken off the site and used for energy purposes. There are values associated with landfill properties which the county simply wants to ignore. What it has said is, we made a mistake. Not that it can identify what that mistake really is, that we realized that the tax assessment was inaccurate. They've not attempted to show that or anything of the kind. They've
haven't said, they, at least the intimation here was, A, if we were to grant this, in other words, go ahead and agree with your position, that would be creating a new right for your client. And secondly, that the county said, well, we may have been mistaken, but we were euchred, used their phrase, into this transaction. Now, as I read the briefs, as I understood it, the county gave the power to their the county clerk, as I recall, to take tax deeds, and what they're saying, they made a mistake, he didn't know what he was doing, and perhaps there was some thought about getting rid of this property. Well, How do you handle that?
And let me address that last point first. It is difficult to identify where the mistake arose. It's just a mistake that the county now owns this property. Looking at the tax deed itself in this case indicates that the former owner of the property was an entity known as Jackson County Sanitary Landfill, Inc. It is a difficult argument to make that this was a mistake made by the county clerk or anybody else within the county, that they were not aware or should not have been aware that they were taking title to a property that was a landfill. And it would be a bad precedent indeed to adopt the rule which Mr. Butler has advocated here, that the law should provide broad discretion, presumably unlimited in time, in order to correct errors. There must be some burden on the part of the county in order to protect its interests. One of the principles raised by the county in its brief was that one of the fundamental duties of government is to protect the public interest. Well, that certainly is true, but by allowing the county to engage in the activities that it has engaged in thus far would be to excuse its actions, which could clearly be argued were not in the public interest.
Isn't there a real concern here? I mean, if you get underneath the case, isn't the concern here that you can have a party that's responsible for tax obligations that can simply just walk away, say, well, we don't think the land is worth anything, so we're not paying taxes. And on the one hand, if the county then invokes its right to invoke a tax deed, now we can walk away from the responsibility. And if the county doesn't invoke its right for the tax deed, we just don't pay taxes. Isn't that what's going on underneath the case?
Well, there are a couple of issues here. One is the windfall question that I want to address, which is that the record is also clear that there is a long-term fund that's been established by Mr. McNulty, and it currently has nearly $700,000 in it in order to provide for the long-term care of this facility. This is not a situation in which Mr. McNulty or Jackson County Sanitary Landfill is walking away from long-term obligations. It's put in hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to provide for the long-term care of this facility. The county is concerned about some potential future obligation that may arise. There's no evidence that there's environmental contamination on this site. There is no evidence that the county will incur any significant amount of money in the future. That's a concern they have. But that concern shouldn't be the basis for establishing an entirely new rule of law, which disregards the underlying purpose of real estate rules and the like, and the statutes that govern the issuance of tax deeds. Now, as to the second issue, what we've been told is that the county wants us to take the property back, but it has never told us that we would be relieved of our tax obligation, which in and of itself suggests that we owe it, which in and of itself suggests that there's value and there's a basis for imposing a tax. And to answer Justice Prosser's question from earlier, there is a legal basis for imposing a tax without issuing a tax deed, and that's to take a personal judgment. Under 74.53, the county may pursue a tax liability through a personal judgment. Now, if the county believed that the basis for rescinding this tax deed was actually the one provided for in 7522, they would have acknowledged at some point in the process, we don't owe any tax. But we're standing here today sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. We're either going to be subject to this tax under this statute, or we're going to get the property back and still be subject to the tax under that statute as to a personal judgment.
How can you take a personal judgment when there's a corporation involved in the property taxes and you got the property?
or they got the property?
That's a conundrum. We don't. I guess I can't answer for you because they have the ability to collect their taxes through one of two methods, and perhaps. I guess maybe I'm not following your question, Justice Prosser, but I think my point is if they do take the property, they can satisfy the taxes through the sale, through the use, generating some income from this property, which they've not shown that they can't do, or they can take a personal judgment against the corporation, which is a party to these proceedings.
Corporation might have other property other than this property.
True,
right?
Which would be subject to property taxes, which presumably we are paying, Your Honor. The another important issue I think which has to be addressed is what is the county ultimately trying to rescind? Because it has continued to say that it's rescinding a tax deed, but that's not very clear language, and it's not a correct way to characterize what's occurred here. The county board has the ability under common law rules to rescind prior actions it has taken. The action that it took was to authorize the clerk to issue a tax deed. It didn't issue the tax deed. What it sought to do, and in even that their own resolution reflects that fact, which is they resolved to rescind the prior authorization that led to the issuance of the tax deed. But with respect to the rules governing the ability of a government entity to rescind its prior actions, it cannot rescind if there's been a change in status that affects vested rights and interests. And I want to address that point that Mr. Butler stated, which is detrimental reliance is not the standard. And in fact, under Kenosha County, which is the case that they rely on, the standard is stated fairly clearly. And it says, in order for rescission to be available to the county, the change in status of the parties or their property must occur. I'm sorry, let me restate that. In order for rescission to be unavailable, the change in status of the parties or their property must occur between the original decision and its reconsideration. It talks about change in status of parties or their property. The original decision here was the authorization to the county clerk to issue a tax deed. The subsequent rescission was to rescind that authorization. In the meantime, the county clerk issued a tax deed which instantly changed the status of the parties and their property.
Counselor, if they rescinded the county clerk's authorization, which I think was given in like 1905, would rescind it back to the date that it was given, then what happens to all the tax deeds between 1905 and today? Is there any effect in your opinion
well,
on it if the rescission is proper?
In my position, if the rescission is proper, certainly that calls into question, potentially anyway, every tax deed that has been issued since 1905. Because according to Mr. Butler's rule, there should be no limit in time. It should be as long as one needs. So we would have a situation here in this case in which we'd have to examine every tax deed to determine whether there's been some reliance or whatever the standard is that the county here is advocating to determine whether the action that the county has actually taken here has invalidated every tax deed issued since 1905. Our position is that is an absurd result, and it certainly has not occurred and should not occur. And it shouldn't occur for the same reason that the rescission of the prior authorization does not impact the validity of the tax deed that was issued in this case.
Justice Prosser.
Let me just tell you what's on my mind. I'm not really very comfortable at the moment with the idea that there was a mistake here. But I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that property owners can somehow maneuver around and dump property on local governments that could be incredibly costly. It's almost like fraud.
Your Honor, I guess in this case there's no evidence of any bad intent. There was an individual property taxpayer, in this case Mr. McNulty and JCSL, who believed that the assessment that was being imposed on him and this property was excessive. He has the right to not pay his taxes if he believes that the assessment that's being imposed and the taxes that are being imposed on him are excessive. What Mr. McNulty and JCSL did here was to simply stand back and watch the property tax proceedings move forward. If that is somehow fraud, it would create a whole new rule for fraud. And importantly, the circuit court addressed the issue of the equitable claim that the county has brought here. And that's really not the subject of this appeal at all, because the circuit court stated that, quote, the county's actions offend the court's sense of justice and fair play. I mean, the circuit court looked at this, evaluated the equitable claims, and said Tom McNulty is a taxpayer sitting there essentially taking it at every turn. He's told he owes the tax. He objects to that. When he doesn't pay the tax, the county takes his property. They take the property to, you know, depriving him of it. And then they say, oh, by the way, all of this was a mistake, and we get to redo all of our actions. Now, in this instance, it's possible. It is possible that there is some negative repercussion that would affect the county at some point in the future. That's not in the record. There's no basis for it here. But ultimately, to excuse the county for this action, which is clearly not a mistake, would essentially allow the county to avoid taking responsibility for correct and wise decision-making in the first instance and impose the burden on a property taxpayer like Tom McNulty, who simply says, I shouldn't owe these taxes, and I'm going to object, and I'm not going to pay them. He shouldn't be characterized as the villain in any respect, and the circuit court recognized that when it held as it did.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. Mr. Dawson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the DNR.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Thomas Dawson. I do represent the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, not the Department of Justice. With me at counsel's table is DNR Attorney Daniel Graff at the far end. I'm here to address the issue of whether, in the event this court holds that the landfill is owned by Jackson County, Jackson County is bound by the long-term care provisions of the state solid waste law. For the sake of my argument, I have to assume that Jackson County has acquired ownership of the Jackson County Sanitary Landfill. There are three prongs to my argument today. First, the Jackson County Sanitary Landfill is a licensed landfill under Section 289.46 sub 1, which makes it subject to the long-term care requirements in its license. Second, and I think perhaps even more importantly, the provisions of Section 289.41, as opposed to 46, inform our interpretation of 289.46, and they independently impose financial responsibility and long-term care requirements on the owner of a landfill, no matter who that owner is. 289.41 imposes these requirements, no matter who the owner might be, regardless of whether the landfill was licensed at the time ownership changed hands. And third, because licensing is not crucial to the requirements for long-term care being imposed, it's our position that Jackson County's demand for a hearing on the factual issue regarding the expiration of the license is irrelevant, and no further hearing on that issue is required. Now, I'd like to begin by...
I'm going to interrupt you just as a procedural matter.
Yes.
I look through this record. The trial court, Judge DeChambeau, made a ruling. County owned the land. There were motions after that, and there were motions for reconsideration, and there are briefs in this, and it seems as if there are a number of different orders that or decisions that Judge DeChambeau did. And the last one that I could find was the January 31, 2005. And it says, he's been asked this a number of times, as far as I can tell. And again, he says that the county owns the land, right?
Yes.
He never seems to deviate from that.
No.
Always owns the land, says there's no vested interest, nothing's been shown, nothing inequitable. Okay. And then the DNR comes in to the case. before DeChambeau, or at least there's some references, the DNR, and you may have even filed a brief. I'm not quite sure about that. And then he says that winds up saying, for the reasons set forth, he's not going to change his August 13th ruling, which says the county owns the land. However, did he say anything else in the August 13th, 2004 decision? But his last line is, however, the court adds a declaration that the county is responsible for the ownership requirements found in 289, 292, and otherwise.
Yes.
You object to that? I mean, what are you doing here? Did you win?
Well,
in the circuit court?
First of all, the Department of Natural Resources is a respondent. And Jackson County sought a declaration not only about the ownership,
right,
but that the DNR could not impose the long-term care or spill requirements against it. And so Judge DeChambeau ruled on those issues.
And what did he say?
He said that they are bound by the long-term care provisions, but there was a subsection in the spill statute where he ruled that and I would characterize it more as dicta, but he said that the county may not be liable under the spill statute, which is different from the long-term care statute.
All right. That's what I'm trying to get at. So what are you interested in? According to your brief, you object, and I'm looking at parts 2 and 3, and 2... That deals with the spills law.
Yes, and that was stricken. 2 and 3 were stricken.
I understand that. So
long-term care is still in play.
And did you win on that?
I believe so.
Do you know?
Do you know? I mean, this is one of the things that's bothering me, is I'm not sure what the trial court said after at least reading in the appendix some of the trial court's decisions, but not all of them. So I want to know what it is
we
the trial prevail. Court said that, so if you won, why do they think you have to do a cross appeal? And then as part of that question, if you look at your briefs, you're objecting to findings of the court, some of its dicta or some of its explanation, but then you don't seem to be objecting to its bottom line, which you say you won, although you do object to them making decisions that should have been made by the administrative agency. So I want to know, why did you have to file a cross appeal in the Court of Appeals opinion when you're not objecting to the ultimate holding? That's number one. So what are you doing here, Mr. Dawson?
Well, first of all...
As a friend.
Yes.
We always like to see you. Right.
First of all, the lower court did find that in the event Jackson County owns the landfill, it is bound by the long-term care requirements.
Okay.
And therefore, that puts us in the position of being a defendant respondent, not a plaintiff appellant. The judge, however, in one of his rulings, talked about the spill statute.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe it's a complete finding, but nevertheless, he suggested that the county may not be on the hook under the spill statute.
We object. No, but in the ultimate one, he said the county is bound by the two statutes, whole chapters.
Well, Chapter 289 is the comprehensive solid waste management chapter.
Mm-hmm.
291 is the spill.
And he didn't list that?
2 is the spill law. And it was on the spill issue that our brief was stricken. However, very alive before this court is the issue of whether Jackson County is bound by the long-term care provisions of Chapter 289,
okay,
particularly 289.41.
Counselor, on the spill issue, the landfill in McNulty, well, the landfill, I guess, is the one that owns it, Jackson County Landfill, the corporation owns the property. They're still on the hook under Chapter 292 if there's a toxic spill. Two, they don't escape from that liability.
We
agree.
Do you
think they do?
we agree they're on the hook for that.
Well, arguably, I should say, since the issue isn't before us, but it is prior owners are covered under 292 if they contributed to the toxic spill that's on the property. So the real beef is who's going to maintain this property, being it's a plain old closed-up landfill that does have maintenance responsibilities, right?
That's how I see it.
Thank you.
That's under 292?
289.
289. Okay.
Mr. McLeod, and I want to get
Mr. Dawson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dawson. I apologize. Things happen fast here. With respect to 289.46, you mentioned earlier in your argument that whether or not the license was expired is irrelevant. And I'm looking at 289.46 sub 1. Any person acquiring rights of ownership, possession, or operation in a licensed solid or hazardous waste facility, and so on and so forth. The way the statute reads, I'm curious to hear why you think the license situation is irrelevant.
Our argument is that license means a solid waste facility that was licensed, and this was licensed. This facility was licensed. Now, we make an argument that based on the content of 289.46 alone, that conclusion ought to be reached. However, we make an additional argument, and I would like to emphasize that argument, that the rest of 289, particularly subsection 41, as opposed to 46, informs the meaning of that statute, and even if we were to agree that 289.46 applies only to a facility licensed at the time of acquisition, there are a host of statutes that make quite clear that the owner, by virtue of mere ownership, the owner of a landfill is required to meet the long-term care and financial responsibility requirements of the law. And let me cite those sections, and I cite them in our brief at pages 14 to 15. Sections 289.41 sub 1M, that's both in parentheses 1M, 289.41 paren 2A, 289.41 paren 10, 289.41.11, and part of the administration of the statute is Wisconsin Administrative Code 520.04. Let me just read two of those sections. 289.41.2a, for example, provides, quote, the owner or operator of a solid or hazardous waste disposal facility shall maintain proof of responsibility ensuring the availability of funds for compliance with the closure and long-term care requirements specified in any rule, order, plan of operation, or other plan approval. Another example, 289.41 paren 10, quote, a person acquiring ownership, possession, or operation of a solid or hazardous waste facility shall establish proof of financial responsibility as required under subsection 2, which I just read you.
Counselor, also, you cited the natural resources Chapter 520 in your brief repetitively, and that seems to speak in some sections specifically to the owner. It doesn't say owner or operator, it just says owner.
Yes, in some cases the statutes and or rules talk about just the owner, others owner and operator, others are particular depending on particular situations, yeah. Whether it's approved landfill or a non-approved landfill.
Now, how do you read those particular statutes and code provisions when you put them up against 7514 sub 4?
I put them up by saying this, that 289.4110 is specific not only as to referring to landfills, but it's also specific to the issue of, quote, person acquiring ownership. There's no limitation there within that language that the ownership has to be by tax deed.
And the reason I asked the question is, I understood that was Judge DeChambeau's decision in this matter as well, I believe on pages 10 and 11 of his decision. But the reason I asked the question is, I understand the rule of statutory construction, specific versus general, That's generally one that's applied when statutes are in conflict. Correct me if I'm wrong. And my understanding is that before you get to a conflict setting, one of the basic tenets of statutory construction is you're to harmonize the statutes where possible. And can you not harmonize 7514 with the other provisions that you just read?
You can, but only if you conclude that a person acquiring ownership is going to be responsible for the long-term care provisions of the law. Otherwise, you have a conflict, and the statute that really speaks to this issue is not 75.14 sub 4, because it's a very general type statute. 289.4110 is very specific, not only to long-term care and landfill, but also as to any person acquiring ownership. There's no limitation there as to how the ownership might be acquired. I would suggest that that statute is one that really governs here.
Well, let me just posit this, because this is, and maybe this is the gist of opposing counsel's argument, but I just want to make sure I understand both positions clearly. When you look at 7514 sub 4, during the period that the county is the owner of lands acquired, it shall not be required to expend money to keep the premises in sanitary or sightly condition, or to contribute to the cost of maintaining private roads, or to abate nuisances or undesirable conditions, but its successors in title shall be subject thereto and to the covenants and restrictions as provided in this section. Now, assuming, and we've heard the argument, that, well, maybe the land does have some value, methane, gas, or whatever, that there could be some value, that would seem to contemplate that there is the possibility of a successor that could exist in the future. So can't you read this statute to be somewhat of a pass-through from the county in harmonizing with the other statutes, that the prior owner has a long-term responsibility? If there's a subsequent owner, the subsequent owner will obtain the license and is responsible for the long-term responsibility. But the county is merely a pass-through if it acquires the land in a tax deed type manner, and so that there really is no conflict.
If you're referring to the county as a successor, then I believe that is one way to reconcile the statutes. If you can't reconcile them, I think it's pretty clear that 289.41 sub ted settles the issue. It is specific to the issue. 7514 is much more general. I see my time is up.
Yes, well, let me just ask you this. So how would you write the opinion? We're assuming that the county has won, or lost, I should say, and it's the owner. So what kind of opinion do you want here relating to the DNR?
There should be an affirmance of the circuit court's decision to the effect that the owner of the landfill is bound by its long-term care and financial responsibility requirements under the statutes that I've cited.
And which order of the court are we dealing with? Which memorandum decision?
Which
date?
DeChambeau. Which Judge DeChambeau decision? Mm-hmm. I'm at a loss. I'm sorry.
Because I only see that in the last one, which was in 2005. Is that right? Dealing with the issues of the county? Or am I wrong?
It appears to be at least included in the motion, in the decision on motion for reconsideration, and I believe
that the
that
August
is at page 11.
Of what date? August?
January 31, 2005.
Five, yes. But the notice of appeal that we have, it deals with the August order.
My understanding is that that both were the subject of appeal.
I'm looking at the Court of Appeals appendix here, 190-192. The notice of appeal. appeal. Do I have the wrong one? But I thought the notice of appeal was from the August.
I believe we have a consolidated appeal.
So you've got it from the other one. Got it. Got it. So that would be the January 2005 order.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Butler?
My time is limited, so pardon me if I skip around a bit, Your Honors. First, to the points made by Mr. Dawson, I think he said that they wanted to keep McNulty on the hook, but as I read 289.41.1MC, McNulty is off the hook once the operating license is transferred to the county, which is what the DNR says it wants to do.
Well, how do they include? As I understand it, it's not only the county that could be on, that is on, but also the predecessor, the person that sold it, or the owner before that. Isn't that what?
I think they were talking about Chapter 292, because it was my question. Right. 292 is a cleanup of toxic spills, and they're really griping about the 289.
You're absolutely right, and I take that back. Mr. Dawson, when asked about the language of 289.46, rather quickly wanted to move, it seemed, to 289.41, and I think there's a reason for that, and that is that the department's construction of 289.46 simply doesn't make any sense. The DNR's construction of 289.46 makes no sense, of sub 1. If my license to practice law were revoked 6 months ago, and I came before you and said I'm licensed to practice law, I think you would be very, very unhappy if you found out that the license was revoked 6 months ago, because by saying to you I'm licensed, I mean I am currently licensed. I'm using an adjective. It's not the past tense of a verb, as they suggest it is in 289.46.1. They read licensed in that subsection to mean ever licensed, ever, even if the license isn't still in effect. Nonsense. Licensed means currently licensed. That's the only sensible construction to give to the term, particularly in light of the fact that sub 1 deals with the transfer of a licensed facility, and sub 2 of that very statute deals with a transfer of a facility that was previously operated but isn't being operated anymore. 289.46.1 speaks specifically to the kind of issue we've got here. 289.41 does not. 289.41 is a set of general prescriptions about what owners and operators have to do. And it doesn't address the kind of change that we're talking about here. I'm reminded of what was attributed to former Supreme Court Justice Jackson. Don't concern yourselves with the language of the statute unless the legislative intent is unclear. Obviously, the legislative intent of 289.46 was to deal with changes in ownership and operation. And the same could be said, Justice Jackson's aphorism applies to the argument about Chapter 75, which was intended to protect counties from a tax by former owners of property that they lost through tax deeds. That statute simply doesn't apply to this situation.
So what's the answer to the question that you asked during your earlier comments of what's the DNR doing here trying to shift the responsibility to the county? What's your answer?
I don't know the answer, and I would like to do discovery on that issue. If you decide that we're the owner, you should remand so that we can find out. Is it because they think that the $700,000 isn't sufficient for the long-term care, and they want the county taxpayers to foot the bill instead of the special fund that they have intended to deal with such exigencies? Don't know, because we didn't have a chance to develop a factual record. I don't know why Mr. McNulty wouldn't be delighted to get this property back and provide a methane plant or a golf course.
Well, maybe he doesn't want it. Or maybe he doesn't want to pay all of the taxes when he hasn't had the property in the last several years.
And if we don't have any way of collecting them except to take a tax deed, he's in that city because we don't want the property again. The Kenosha County case, it was suggested, does not support our position that that detrimental reliance has to exist before there can be successful opposition to a decision. Just one point about the Kenosha County case. The language that counsel read was that the change in status of the parties or their property must occur before the action or between the action and the rescission. But in that case, the change in the position of the parties occurred as soon as the town put its zoning ordinance into effect. Everyone's land who was subject to that zoning ordinance, all those folks, their interest in their property changed because it was now subject to the zoning ordinance. So the court didn't quite mean what it said there, I suggest to you. And if you read the entire decision, it's clear they're talking about detrimental change. Finally, as to whether there's 100 years of uncertainty over the deeds, there is at page 177 of our appendix the resolution of the Board of Supervisors of Jackson County that says that all tax deeds previously issued by or on behalf of Jackson County, and et cetera, are ratified and approved, except, of course, the one in question. So we don't have, that's a non-issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Butler, and thank you, Mr. Dawson, and thank you, Mr. McLeod, for your argument on a case we ordinarily don't have, namely, no one wants the property. We're usually fighting about who should have the property, and here everybody is pointing the finger to the other person, so that's a little unusual, but understandable. That concludes the hearing on 04AP2582 and 05AP545, Jackson County versus State of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Before I close,